This is David O'Donohue, Creativity's Underworld Descent, October 25th, 1993.
So far this year, as we've tried to study creativity in Jung, we had the privilege of having Carl Lipkin talk to us early on in the season about the image. And he showed us some lovely images throughout history of great art, and how if we just look at the image, psyche speaks to us through it. And then we had Linda Shepherd, who talked about it to us about creativity and science and the feminine. On October 16th, we had an event in which we actually went deeper into what creativity is to people and isn't with Tom Jay, and then with Robert Davidson, talked about the body and releasing the body, and how when we release tensions in the body, we also release creative energies. And tonight, we're going to have as our speaker Dr. David O'Donohue, who's a clinical psychologist, and he's going to talk to us about the descent, creativity's underworld descent, and how not only do we go under, and it's a necessary process sometimes to go into those darker places to come out with creative new ways of living and also creative art. David specializes, he's a therapist, he's a faculty member of the Antioch University, and he specializes in art therapy. He runs regular weekly groups in creativity and impromptu, David?
We're all part of a group that does that.
I see. Okay. And he has a special thing on his agenda this year, and that is he's going to take a month off to go to Bali and study spirituality and creativity. So I'm interested this evening to hear what you have to say, David, and I present to you now Dr. David O'Donohue.
First of all, let me find out if we have a few more people than we expected, so I wondered if the people in the back, it's all right if I sit? Is that going to be a problem for folks to kind of see me over the heads of... I'm just more comfortable sitting, so I wondered if that... I may pop up when I get inspired, so, you know, you may see me up, but I prefer that. If you all back there, are you all right back there with me at this angle? Okay. What I'd like to do to start out with is I'd like to read you probably the classic quote from Jung about what he saw the creative process being. And some of you may know this. It's kind of like reading from the first book of Jung. You know, it's one of those things that we're supposed to do at a Jung Society gathering. But I think it really, Jung was so articulate about capturing these very, very difficult and complex processes and honoring them. So I'd like to read this, it's about a half a paragraph here. Analysis of artists consistently shows not only the strength of the creative impulse arising from the unconscious, but also its capricious and willful character. The biographies of great artists make it abundantly clear that the creative urge is often so imperious that it battens on their humanity and yokes everything to the service of the work, even at the cost of health and ordinary human happiness. The unborn work in the psyche of the artist is a force of nature that achieves its end either with tyrannical might or with the subtle cunning of nature herself. Now let me read that again. The unborn work in the psyche of the artist is a force of nature that achieves its end either with tyrannical might or with the subtle cunning of nature herself, quite regardless of the personal fate of the person who is its vehicle. The creative urge lives and grows in him like a tree in the earth from which it draws its nourishment. We would do well, therefore, to think of the creative process as a living thing implanted in the human psyche. In the language of analytical psychology, this living thing is an autonomous complex. It is a split-off portion of the psyche which leads a life of its own outside the hierarchy of consciousness. Depending on its energy charge, it may appear either as a mere disturbance of consciousness, of conscious activities, or as a subordinate authority which can harness the ego to its purposes. So we're dealing with some pretty heavy stuff in creativity. And for some people, it can't be taken lightly. For some people, it's a major change in their life. It's a major encounter with something that is very frightening and compelling, so that they must make some kind of reorientation about their life in that process. Now, many of us are not called to that level of transformation, but I think in some form or another, when we are touched by the creative urge, we go through a descent of some kind. And I want to talk tonight about the descent literature in mythology and how it mirrors much of the work in the creative process that researchers have uncovered over the years. So I'm going to be taking one model of the creative process that was first developed by Joseph Wallace in 1926. Now, I don't know much about Joseph Wallace or what his background is, but he is kind of the classic in terms of the four stages of the creative process. And these are articulated on your little map here. For some of you that came in late, did you get those? Good. Okay. So what I wanted to do is just to lay those out to begin with. There's first of all preparation, then incubation, illumination, and then I have added another stage in here, adjustment. That wasn't Wallace's original, but it fits my model, so I kind of fit that in, and we're going to talk about what that is in particular. And finally, verification. Okay. So tonight we're going to go through this map. We're going to follow along with it from beginning with the encounter and moving downward and away from the collective into the encounter with the unconscious and with the collective forces, and then back up again into the return. And each stage has its own phenomenology. Each stage has its own qualities of experience that kind of help define it and also help to help us to understand that perhaps this will end. In much of my work with creative people, if they're in the incubation stage, for instance, it's felt to be very painful and very sometimes chaotic and confusing. And with my work with the creative person, I need to say this is part of the process, to kind of normalize it. And as you think about some of your own struggles with creativity, maybe this model will help to know that there is a kind of a normalization in terms of your own experience, that it's all part of the process, that if at one point you feel blocked in your creativity, or you don't feel at, you know, you feel that there's a lot of, at one point, a great inspiration or a great idea, and then you wake up the next morning and it's gone, don't think that, you know, what are the gods doing with me? They're playing with me, or, well, they may be playing with you. That may be true, but it all may be part of the process. So not to let go of the thread of the creative. That's my intention here, is this might help you not let go of certain projects that you might have started because suddenly the energy is gone, but to kind of normalize that and to say this is all part of the descent, because the descent is a painful process. This is not an ascent. This is not an opening up and a being rewarded with all these great spiritual insights. That may come later or in synthesis, but initially it's going to feel like you've been hit by a 10-foot club or something like that. So anyway, let's move into this. First of all, let's start with preparation, and I have a small quote from Dante. The first, when he starts his the Inferno, he starts out, "Midway this way of life we're bound upon, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, where the right road was wholly lost and gone." Now that's a very interesting way to start out this epic, because it's saying a lot of things just in that one sentence. It's saying that there's something about midlife. There's something about this being in the middle of your life and having probably attained a certain level of comfort with your path, and all of a sudden kind of waking up and finding yourself off of it and in a dark wood. It's not like you're coming into a kind of a holy clearing where everything is distinct and beautiful, but it's like there's a sense that this is ominous and gloomy. And if you think about fairy tales and you think about mythic motifs, they're often very gloomy. There's a kind of a sense of foreboding that you don't quite know what this area is going to be about. You know, in fairy tales, the motif of the forest, the dark forest, is often seen as a metaphor for the encounter with unconscious forces. That there's often kind of a nice, safe home where things aren't quite right. Like if you look at Hansel and Gretel, there's a lot of pathology in that. But the urge to get away from the trauma that required the children to be in the woods brought forth some changes and some transformations. So the woods are the place where there's often the encounter with animal forces, with more unconscious forces. So we're seeing here that in the preparation for the journey, one needs to be ready for encounter. Heidegger talks about this a lot in his philosophy. He talks about the clearing, and he turned around ontology, where it used to be that what we were after was grasping the nature of being, that philosophers were trying to cognize what is the nature of being, and if you can see it as a way of kind of grasping hold of something and in a way conquering it, that's kind of the modern dilemma, is trying to get enough cerebral functioning so that you can grasp something. Well, Heidegger turned that completely around, and he said that it's been since Plato and after that philosophy has been on the wrong track. Now, that's a long time for philosophy to be on the wrong track. What he says is that people stopped encountering being. They stopped being willing to be open to being interrogated by being itself. That there needs to be a willingness to receive being and to be kind of at the disposal of being rather than grasping it. So you see the difference here? You see how that opening, that space, requires a change of perhaps the way you're functioning in the world, which might require a lot of adeptness and a lot of focus and a lot of conquering of things. Well, this sacred space is a place of encounter. So when I'm teaching, I teach this class in creativity, which this is a kind of a compendium of what I do in 10 weeks. And one of the things we do is we have people design a model of their sacred space. I ask them to design a kind of a situation in which they will be most open to this being. And in that place, which can be a studio, it can be a walk in the woods, it can be a clear desk, it could be being out in nature, it could be with family members, with a child, being in the presence of a child, can often, you can suddenly have this awareness that you're in touch with being in its rawness. That's what we're talking about in terms of preparation. And another factor of preparation is separation. And in separation, what we're talking about is a breaking away from the collective, from the norming. When we think about the way we live, we need to also think that we are conditioned thought by thought in terms of how we, that we don't have a lot of room for creative thoughts if one thought automatically leads to another. You know, the behaviorists were great on this. They really captured this sense of conditioning, that unconsciously we get conditioned and we naturally think of one thing leading to another, leading to another. Krishnamurti talked about this, saying that creativity can't come from thinking. That thinking is conditioned. Thinking is one thought and it determines the next thought. And that we don't have a lot of play in there. There's not a lot of opportunity to have a new sense of something different. So this separation requires a leaving behind of what's familiar to us. It's a leaving behind of some anchoring. And that can be felt to be very frightening, very anxiety-provoking. It can be a kind of a sense of calling where you feel that something is drawing you from inside that is going to make a difference in terms of how you're living your life. And that calling, it's kind of like the Annunciation, you know, with Mary. You know, she had a lot to deal with when the angel came to her. You know, there were a lot of ramifications to this act, and she really didn't get consulted too much. It was pretty much, you know, hey, I'm informing you about something. And then there's many images in art of her reflecting on these things. I think that's even from the Bible, that she took from the angel this sense of she needed to take that in, that what is going to be the ramifications of this calling that I've received. And Dante too, when he met Virgil, it was a scary thing for him to meet this great man and to find that the journey that Virgil was proposing was going to take him into the very depths of hell. And this is something that we have to be open to, that the creative process may lead us into areas which we don't want to go on the ego. Okay? That there's another process going, which the ego may actually be frightened of. I wanted to mention the Phyllis Greenacre. I'm going to be interweaving some psychoanalytic theory and some Jungian theory in here just to kind of amplify this a little bit. Phyllis Greenacre in 1948 wrote that the ego of the artist is able to dissociate itself from real objects and thus develops a love affair with the world much like a two-year-old. In other words, those objects lose their significance. They lose their kind of programmed significance, and artists are able to move away from those objects and see them in different lights. They're able to see a chair not as an object to sit on, but as an object that may have a whole abstract form, or may be able to see through the chair and see the negative spaces, and maybe the chair outlines something behind the chair that becomes the significant piece. This is the dissociation process. This is when a chair is not a chair is not a chair anymore. This is when you suddenly let the chair be something else. And in this love affair with the world, if you know two-year-olds at all, there's also something that happens psychologically with two-year-olds. They're very tempestuous. They've got a lot of energy. They've got a lot of a sensitivity. That very sensitivity that the artist has can also bring about a kind of an emotional lability, a sense of preciousness, where they need to make sure that they're not around situations that will hurt their sensitivities. They may have a great awareness of color or light or sound, and because of that, they need to isolate. And so, out of this, they can tend to remove themselves from social interaction. And what happens in that, as I am certainly aware in my practice, is that when we are able to interact socially with others, there's a kind of a feedback loop that occurs. Freud called this reality testing, that you could call a friend and say, am I crazy? Or, you know, I have these feelings about something and I want to check this out. Is this okay? You know, am I on the wrong track? And your friends may say, well, it does sound, if they're good friends, they may say, you know, it does sound like you're kind of overreacting. Maybe there's more here than just that. Or you might hear from your friends, no, it sounds really right that you're having a reaction that feels appropriate. But the point here is that our social interaction helps us kind of modify our psyches. It keeps our internal life more, like the whole becomes smaller in terms of what we allow to come up. Now, if we isolate, if we move into a hut in the woods and we don't see people, it can actually, that area can become larger. Have any of you done this where you've done extended periods of time alone? Is that let's see some hands of people that, okay, a few of you. Well, I think it's a very interesting experience. Did you find that there was more material that was available for you? There's something about allowing that separation to occur, which then you need to be careful. Just checking in every so often, making sure that this hole doesn't get too large. Because as I'm talking, you're going to hear that I'm very respectful of these archetypes, and I really see them as being much more powerful than our egos. So all along the way in the journey, even though that kind of someplace in here there's a kind of a free fall, which you're going to have to trust. But at this stage, when you're in this incubation stage, you're right at the entrance of that. Prepare yourself for it. Get yourself ready in terms of saying, letting people know, hey, I'm going into this place. I'm going into. I have a number of friends that call me and say, I'm going down, you know, and that's all they need to say. And they know, and I'm there. And I say, okay, well, you know, if you need to call me, I know you're going down. And then I kind of keep them in my thoughts. But it's kind of good to know where people are, and that also makes it more of an intentional act. And I have a sense that we can actually be more intentional about our descents, that we can, I think Jung wanted to do this in terms of his work, is that if recognizing that there was pain and suffering in the world, kind of the Buddhist adage that life is suffering, that if we can do it more consciously, if we can say, all right, I'm going down, you know, I'm descending. If there can be a kind of a will there that's saying, I'm going to get from this descent what I need to get, instead of going, oh no, I'm getting depressed. Help! I gotta go to a movie, I gotta get some food in me, I gotta do something to stop this. It's like, there's something down there for you. You know, it may be very painful, but my belief is that there is something there. And that's what myths are showing us too, is that there's something there. So we need to separate. So we need to move out of the collective. One of the nicest, I think, descriptions of this separation is the myth of Inanna. That's a Sumerian myth. It's probably one of our earliest myths that we have extant. It predates any of the Greek myths. And in that story, it's the queen wishes to. And there's various interpretations of why she wanted to go. Some were seeing it as a rescue. Some were seeing it as meeting her twin sister, who she had been estranged from, who was the queen of the underworld. But for whatever reason, Inanna took on the journey of the underworld, and she was put through seven gates, and at each gate she needed to discard some of her clothing and some of her jewelry. So if you can imagine her as this regal figure with, you know, in those days the queen probably wore a lot of symbolic garments that represented different things that the culture held sacred. So as the descent was happening, it was like a desacralizing. It's taking off these various symbols of the culture. So it's moving away from those symbolic cultural determinants. And in each gate, the gatekeeper would say, you need to take this off. And then it was down to her loincloth, and she needed to be naked before the queen, the queen of the underworld. This still didn't please the queen, and the queen needed more. And what she then did, let me read you a little bit of an honest story here. Send against her 60 diseases, eye diseases against her eyes, diseases of the side against her side, foot disease against her foot, heart disease against her heart, head disease against her head, against her whole being, against her entire body. Now, doesn't that sound like Job? Doesn't have a ring to, you know, it's like down there, as you go into incubation, you can become sick, you can become a very unpleasant things can be going on down here, as well as a lack of fertility in the descent also of Persephone. You know that in that story, that is the way the Greeks described winter, is that winter was created because Persephone was in the underworld, and that her mother Demeter no longer allowed anything to be fruitful, and so the earth was barren. Likewise in Inanna, after the lady Inanna had gone down into the land of no return, the bull did not mount the calf, the ass approached not the she-ass, to the maid in the street no man drew near, the man slept in his apartment, the maid slept to herself. So you see in this process a whole, that cosmically everything stops. There's no creativity in the world, in the land at this time. So her time down there requires this barrenness. Okay? And And that, I think, mythically is saying that we all are going to experience that, no matter if we're not as noble as Inanna and we're doing this journey quite to the extent that she is, there still is going to be times when we are barren. The Inferno in Dante and also in the Aeneid involves also an interesting part about wild beasts crossing the path. That there are a number of situations where the best known is probably Cerberus, who is the dog, the three-headed dog with the barbed tail that protects the underworld and kind of guards against any mortals that are trying to just kind of haphazardly wander down there. So there are other animals that cross the path in Dante. I think a lion and a she-wolf and a number of other animals. And when we begin to think about what those animals might represent, I think Freud might give us a clue here. Freud saw the creative process as being very similar to the neurotic process, in that there is a great power in, as he called it, the id, which is this. The id is not structured like Jung's unconscious. The id is just raw need and desire, and it's instant gratification. And Freud called it very infantile, in that we have a need and we gratify it, and we go for these needs. And he sees that in all of us, we have those desires that must be modified by the ego, which has this view of what are the reality constraints. And that there is this battle in the neurotic person and in the creative person, that for some reason, which Freud has many, there's lots and lots of tension in that interaction. But how the creative person resolves that is different than the neuroses. In the neuroses, you have a person who both does not satisfy those desires, so there's always a frustration, but at the same time, his life is so contained, and there's so many defenses that hold down these instincts, that he's not really very functional either, that his whole way of life is disordered or rigid, or he's not responding very well to the world. Now, in the creative person, she can have a whole different response. She can be able to take that energy, honor it, and say, it is good. You know, like God said, it is good. You know, it's like giving this blessing to this energy and saying, maybe this energy is not about this kind of more primal form of expression, but it can be sublimated. In other words, that energy can be channeled and raised up to a higher level, which is what the creative work is about. For Freud, that was a satisfaction, a partial satisfaction of those instinctual urges. So if we look at the animals as a symbol of these instincts, these things that pull us away from the work, you know, the work requires a deliberateness. It requires a focus. And if you have all these wild animals crossing your path all the time, you're not going to stay very focused. So maybe Dante and the myths are saying you need to somehow find a way to placate or to conquer your wild animals. Okay, and different mythic characters did it in different ways. Hercules, in his style, took on the conquest. He intimidated Chiron, the ferryman that ferries people across the River Styx. He intimidated him, and so Chiron ended up taking him across. But he also conquered the dog by wrestling with him, and it's a very much of a model of physical conquest. Whereas in Orpheus charmed Chiron and the dog through his music. So there's a lot of different ways to do this. There's no one path that's the right one. And it would be interesting for you all to think about how you conquer your wild beasts, because each of us have our own way of doing that. And think of, maybe not even in terms of conquest. For some of you, it may be being in relationship with it, so those animals can be free, but they're not crossing your path. Okay, we talked about Inanna. Let's move into incubation and talk about what that is, what that feels like. Incubation is the time when you had felt that there was this impulse in you to be creative. You had felt this inspiration. That's what the preparation is about. You have the encounter. You have this sense that something is moving in me that's very significant, that's worth my time and attention. And then it's gone. and you worry, what is going on with me that I can be so stimulated and so excited about something and then lose it, and then not have it again. And this is a time when many people come into therapy, many people get very despondent, very depressed, they get confused, they ask a lot of existential questions like, what is happening with life? Why do I begin to feel that there's a purpose to life and a meaning, and I think that's all good and right, and then I wake up and it's gone, and I don't know, and am I living wrong, or am I being played with, or this whole trickster aspect, you know? The trickster is a very sacred and important archetype, in that this play in which we think we know what's going on, we really don't. And so part of the incubation period of not having it is a recognition that we need to let go of any kind of sense that it's going to be, we're going to have any clue about what's going on. The mystics talk about this. St. John of the Cross, Teresa Avila, a number of other spiritual teachers describe this, both they call it the cloud of unknowing, the dark night of the soul. In the spiritual quest, there's a time when with all the preparation and all the rigor and all the determination that you are on a spiritual path and you're being devoted to something and you've given up things and you think that you're going to be graced or you're going to be privileged at this point to have encounter because you've made a lot of sacrifices. And then what these mystics found was there wasn't that. There wasn't that time of kind of bliss, but they went into this period where they needed to even let go of that agenda. They needed to let go of the idea that they were hooked into the kind of the effect. Like, if I do this, I'll get that. You know, we're still kind of into this cause and effect thing. It's how we educate children, that if you'll get rewarded if you do this kind of thing. I mean, and it works on a lot of levels, but sometimes on the spiritual level it doesn't work at all, that we can't necessarily have our efforts be rewarded in life. But there's this space where we have to then let go of even that. The Buddhists talk about this in terms of getting hooked into or getting identified with a kind of a deity that rewards, you know, and that is a lower, you know, the Buddhists have many, many levels of deities, and you go through these various levels, and in a way they're more real than the last level, but they're still an illusion too. And they're part of that process that you go through this level of deities, and then you see, aha, yes, you get the joke, you know, you say, I see, okay, that's not what ultimate reality is about, and then you're ready to go on to the next level. So this incubation stage is a real teaching stage that you need to let go of those things and tolerate your pain, which could be around limitation, it could be around being bogged down, you could feel heavy, you could feel in the mire. You know, in alchemical literature, they have all these symbols of the bog and the slime, and the primordial creatures come often out of the slime, and they're all dirty, and they, before they can go into the ritual baths, they have to deal with this slime. It's that kind of place that we get bogged down in things that don't seem to be moving. It can also be a place of anxiety because we have let go of our grounding and we don't anymore have those old ways to say, I'm okay. So to call an old friend and to say, you know, I want to stay in this process, but please just say that this is okay for me to be here, may be very important. It may be important for you to not let go of all your anchors, but also to have your friends and partners to know and to honor that for you, not to help you pull out of it, because they may inadvertently try to help you pull out of it if they don't understand this. They may say, oh, let's go to a movie, or let's, and you may need to go to a movie. I'm not saying that isn't good, but there also may be, it might scare people who are significant to you. You know, this may be like they'll go, oh, you know, I want my old partner back because I want to feel like I've really got them again. And you may have to say, no, it's okay, I need to stay in this. It's what the alchemical literature calls putrefactio. And I love that. It's when things are really smelly and stinky, and if any of you garden, you know, it's like there's this wonderful thing about the putrefactio because it's really connected to the soil and it's connected to the enrichment of the soil. And even you know, the whole process of, I have two dogs and they're large, so there's lots of putrefactio going on in my yard. And you know, there's something that happens, and at first it's really unpleasant, but I watch it as it changes, and it goes through these changes, and it really becomes very fecund, very rich. And there's a way that I see that soil is very connected. You know, soiling, look at that word. We talk about kids soiling their pants or that you've gotten dirty. I mean, it's like we're in this culture where that's bad, but there's something so important about dirt and soil. That's the ground out of which all these seeds are going to come out of. Hillman also talked about this in terms of the decentering of the ego. One of the nicest books that Hillman wrote on this process is Dream and the Underworld, and I really recommend that for a wonderful description of what it's like down there, because he really captures in words and in his research the actual conditions that were down there, what people were dealing with when they went down, especially in classic literature, what it was like to talk to a shade, for instance. It's not a very fulfilling kind of interaction, because a shade is not, I mean, they kind of come and go, and they're not substantial, and you can't grab a hold of a shade. And the underworld is full of spirits that do not have bodies, and so they're dead, you know? We have to face that these things are dead, and we're interacting with them as not totally potentiated active agents, but almost like a sense that they need to be revitalized through our own psyches. So our first encounter with them, with many of my clients, when they're on this journey, they dream about caskets, they dream about burials, they dream about funerals. There's a sense that there's something about the encounter with death that's important in this. And Hillman says that in the decentering of the ego, Hillman's whole thing is that we're way too ego-dominated, that there's many different centers of our consciousness that we can come out of. And if we shift from the ego into other states of consciousness, we'll be enriched by other aspects that we're not aware of, that there's all these other voices. And I think that's what Jung meant by the autonomous complex, that we have all of these lives in us that are wanting to come out. And perhaps in children, they come out a lot. And of course, in the course of development, we need to help them, you know, learn their lessons and do their readings and learn rules, and they need to come out of their imaginal. And some people bemoan that and say it's a shame that that occurs, but it's also part of living in this collective reality. We have to work out some kind of way in which that can be held too, where we actually can be functional in a collective world, but at the same time have these voices present. So for Hillman, that decentering involves a death process. So we can see that down here, that as you go through the incubation, you go through whatever way you can think of this as an ego death, as a death to some part of your ego. It may be larger than another part. And this is a defeat. This is seen not as, you don't know at that point that you're on the verge of some wonderful work. What you think at that point is that everything's falling apart and that you're shit. You know, but you are. That's the putrefaction. Yeah, it's that you have at that point been reduced to shit. But it's fertile, it's rich. And that death experience is the final letting go. And that's where you let go into this kind of free fall. Okay? And that free fall is when these complexes or you move out of the personal. See, this is a place of personal unconscious. So you've been at this point dealing with all of your own stuff, your shame, your anxiety, your anger. You've been the focus here. When you go through the ego death, you lose your focus, and then the work takes on a life. You're beginning to allow this thing, whether it be poetry or art or music, it begins to take on a life of its own. It begins to speak to you. It begins to wake you up at night and say, this is the next movement of this piece, or try this out. Or you begin to focus your life and center it around that piece. Okay? And in fact, this is a great relief, because you've been in a lot of pain in this place of being kind of self-absorbed. in leaving that and moving into the place where you can let the work be your lover, be your companion, you're in a relationship, which is very exciting. It's this externalization of psyche that Jung talks about. And it's not so much around projection, although there's this funny projection. It's not a defensive projection. It's Jung saw two kinds of projections, at least two, but I think two are good in terms of the distinction. One is where we project our personal unconscious onto the world, and we work it out through distancing ourselves from other and through having others play out things about ourselves that we don't like. Another form of projection is archetypal projection. And that's where things are coming from our inner fulcrum, our inner stew, and they're projected out into a work or onto people or onto the world where those archetypes are, where the world becomes clothed in the archetypes. And this is where many poets will wake up and they'll go out and they'll see the scene that they've seen every day, but it'll be completely different. Burma, the Jacob Burma, if I can pronounce it like the Dutch do, he had this revelation by looking at a plate that was situated on his counter, and the light hit it one day. I mean, this is a plate that he saw every day, and it was probably a brass plate, and there was a way that the light hit his plate, and that was the breakthrough. See, it wasn't like he went on top of some mountain, but there was this way that the archetypes became manifested externally. That we don't necessarily need to internalize ourselves so that we're meditating and we're closing our eyes off to the world to be aware of archetypal forces. They come out through an externalization. And they can come out through your medium, through whatever you're interacting with. It begins to have a relationship with you. And you can be angry at it. And you can be, it can be like a fickle lover. It can be like a tempter. It can draw you in and then not be revealing. There can be a clothing and an unclothing. Or it can be very clear about where it's going. But often it will seem kind of crazy. I think, have some of you experienced this? Do some of you know? Okay. Now, an important point here is that you may be okay with it. People in your life may have trouble. Okay? People may in your life may actually get jealous. They may feel slighted. They may feel like they have been abandoned. And this is another piece that's important. When I've seen couples, and often one of them is into this area, and it's not like there is another person that is in their life. It's that there is something moving in them that they have to honor. One person gets needy and the other person is in their process. And they're really needy and they need some attention, and this person, they're feeling these mixed loyalties. Okay? So that is often a problem. I talked about the River Styx. Let me tell you, Otto Rank wrote a lot about creativity, and he said that one of the things that is very important in the artist is the will. We don't hear much about the will anymore. It used to be very popular in kind of the 30s and the 40s, you know, that there was a number of writings about the will. It may have been because, you know, there's a dark side to the will. I mean, Hitler, and there's certain things about willfulness that have a dark aspect, like we need to be more sensitive to collective and diversity and all these things. But back when Rank was writing, he saw that the will sometimes helps support artists through their dark periods. That it's the very act of honoring a kind of a sense of identity that so many people can't. It doesn't mean that it's your whole identity. You may be being moved by something, and you need to be an artist during that process. You need to allow yourself to identify with that identity in order to contain this. You see, the personality needs to contain this stuff. So we need to have a container in our personality that says, yes, I'm an artist, and I'm in the midst of this encounter. And maybe, you know, in a month or so, you're not going to be an artist, you're going to be a parent, you're going to be, I mean, at various times we may be in different roles. But just think about that idea of identifying with the artist as a way of containing this journey. Because once you're called, you can always, many people turn around down here and they say, oh, it's too much, I want out. And then they regret it. They say, gosh, what would it have been like had I followed that? What would it have been like had I really gone down into where it turned? Okay? Now, when it turns, let's talk about phenomenologically what happens at that turning. The return is crucial, of course. You know, what goes on down here, as you see on your paper, there's a lot of dangers in dealing with deep archetypal processes. There's the danger of over-identifying with those energies, and that leads to inflation, where we think that it's us, and that it's all about us, and we get, and it may lead to a kind of a manic energy that we're out there kind of blowing people away because we're it. We've got it. We're next to Michelangelo in our genius and talent. That's a danger, because when you're down there, just as you need to have the will present, there also has to be the sense of humility that you are just following something out, and that it may feel very good to be in that space and not to identify it, not to kind of say, okay, this is all about me. Another problem, which is kind of the opposite of that, is paranoia. What happens in paranoia is that there's a lot of energy, that there's an awareness that there's a kind of a noumenosum, there's an awareness that there's a lot of energy, but it's all externalized. And so the world takes on a very, very frightening aspect, so that you are not very powerful, but the world can impose on you, and so you become frightened. That's also a danger. So both of those are needing to be modified. Likewise, there is the whole sense of psychosis, the whole sense that there can be a downward spiral where those very things that are drawing you could want all of you. You know, the archetypes don't have to eat. When you're down in the underworld, the shades don't take care of you. They don't feed you. They don't take care of your body. They could care less, okay? They really, they want all of you. And you know the idea of the vampire, that image of vampires sucking the life out of people. You know, this is, I think, an archetypal image of the archetypes need our human consciousness to survive. Now, I don't want to make this like they're aliens or anything, but there is a sense that they are demanding, that they require, and we need to say no. You know, we need bumper stickers that say, just say no to archetypes, you know. On a certain level, we need to say no. You know, we need to be able to say, okay, I'm done for today. You might not be able to do it, but there needs to be a stepping away. There needs to be a superficial part of your life. You need to keep that. You can't stay in those depths. You need to say, oh gosh, I need to just go out and play, or I need to go out and go to a movie, or I want to read some trashy novel. It's important to take care of your body, to eat, to make sure you're getting enough sleep. You may not be able to sleep very well, but to try to say, being grounded in the world, being concerned about those daily activities are therapeutic for me in this time. So at that point, you make a decision to reorient yourself to the world. So there's a desire on your part to say, okay, I've been down here now, and I have a good sense of what this is about. Now, how am I going to put this into form? How am I going to be able to express this? Jung was very clear on the need to express our creativity, that it wasn't enough to just experience it. You know, this whole thing about dream work, you know, it's like there is something about recording your dreams and telling another about your dreams that's all part of dream work. It's not enough just to kind of remember your dreams and to say, okay, you know, I try to do this. I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm really lazy and I don't want to write down my dreams. So I try to do a little mini analysis and I try to say, okay, I'm going to understand this completely in these few minutes before I fall back to sleep. And I never remember the dream in the morning. You know, it never serves me. But if I've had a chance to write it down, I'm in a completely different space after I've recorded it. And if I can share it with another person, it becomes richer and richer and richer. So the return is not the loss of this. I want you to hear this, because sometimes people fear that by returning to the collective, you lose something. And there is a sense that we lose the numinosum. We lose that sense of spiritual intensity because we're joining with the collective again. But
I want you to see that there is a need to clothe it and to form it, and you'll actually have something more powerful by the clothing of it. And so there is a need to come back into a collective reality. And at that point, then you reach a point of danger, which involves it can either be a feeling of regression, a feeling of that you may get aware that the limits of your materials, like let's just take an idea of an artist who comes back from a kind of a visionary experience, has her palette out there and all of her paints, and then kind of says, I can't do this. This is a betrayal of this depth that I've been in. I can't work in this medium because it's not going to be true to it. So there's a fear. There's a space there where you want to go back. This is what Freud talked about. And I'm not sure Jung talked about it in terms of regression, but I know Freud saw this regressive thing going where we want to go back into the imaginal. We want to not be in the body. We want to say, oh, I'm a spiritual being, and I want to only be in a spiritual being, and my best encounters are within this sense of being a spiritual being. So if I get incarnate again, I begin to feel this you know, tension in my stomach, and I realize that these paints are just not going to do it, and I've got to find a different medium. I mean, there's a sense that the world is limited. You know, it's like what the Gnostics said about how incarnation is a fall, that we come back into bodies, and we have fallen from another state where it's much more expansive. But we are in these bodies. And so if we say, okay, I'm going to go back into that liminal space, the noumenal space, most likely what will occur is that those encounters won't be as intense. It'll be like, okay, now I'm waiting for it. It's not here. And you're going to feel like you're kind of chickening out. You know, you're not quite living up to the challenges that are presented in the upward journey. And this can really be a climb, okay? So to climb back into the liminal. Now, I didn't explain liminal because that's, we have three different areas here. One is the consensual, which is our consensual reality, where we're all trying to deal with the same suppositions about what is real. The liminal is the between place between that reality and this more archetypal, more deeply spiritual individual place. The liminal is the betwixt and between. It's the place where you have this kind of merging and swirling around of both elements. So some of it is personal material, some of it is archetypal. You get really charged up about something and you find out, oh no, this is just my stuff. This isn't archetypal. This isn't a deeper universal thing. So it's very confusing in the liminal. You're having to then work with this place of synthesis. That's the point that I want to make in the adjustment phase, is that you are returning, perhaps being a changed being, and what you're going to do is to try to integrate your old being with your new being. You're going to try to hold the tensions of those two in you, okay? And in mythological language, this is often seen as the composite figures, like the Sphinx or Pegasus or Griffins, or there's a number of mythic fairy tale figures where you have qualities of animals kind of juxtaposed. Some are animal forms, like the mermaid is a good example. That's a transitional figure where there are qualities of the archetypal merged with human consciousness, especially in the human animal form. It's also represented in the Janus head, J-A-N-U-S. That the Janus is where we get the month of January, and Janus was the god that had two faces, one facing to the east, one facing to the west. And the Janus face is on the in Roman times it was on gateways. So that the image contained both where you've been and where you're going. So this is another way to kind of explicate this idea that in this reemergence, there's a need to reacquaint yourself with your old being. And not to be critical of it, not to say, oh, no, I just want to be new and transformed and fresh, but to say, there's a way for me to bring in my own personhood, my own crap into this work. My own, I don't want to say crap, that's a terrible thing to say. My own richness. There. But the personal stuff, you know, that we're not gods walking around, and that creativity is not about gods coming down and giving forth the fruits. It's about that we have been incarnate, and that we are bringing our humanness into the work. So when you get frustrated with your medium, when you get stuck, this is again a place of stuckness, and it's feeling your mortality, as I wrote on your sheet. It's a feeling of your limitation, and to say, and that's the humility, saying, boy, this is what it's like to be human. This is what it's like to be, I have to go to sleep now. I have to get up and work for 5 days before I can get back to this. Okay, so that all needs to be included into the equation. I wanted to mention David Bohm, because he's done a lot of writing about creativity, and he has written that, he uses the analogy of a stream, and kind of picking up on what Krishnamurti said about that thoughts determine each other, one following another, and following many of what the deconstructionists say about language determining our whole way of thinking, that we are conditioned and that we haven't gotten any really ways of being free in our thoughts or our being, that we need to kind of get away from the conditioning. What Bohm was saying is that if we think of creativity like a stream, that as if we enter into the stream downstream, just like if you have a number of factories along the stream or populated areas, the stream may get polluted. The stream may carry a lot of things in the water that are not pure, that lack that kind of sense of purity. And if we enter in at that point, we're going to have to deal with the impurity. And what Bohm wanted to do was to work back up the stream, to find a way that we could come as close to the source as possible. But he also recognized that as soon as we came up to that source, that we couldn't live there, that there wasn't a way, but we had to let ourselves come back down the stream and allow those impurities to enter in, but that they would be put in a new relationship with each other. Another person that's important here is Claude Lévi-Strauss, his concept of bricolage. He was a structuralist in that he believed that there were certain, very much like Jung, in that there was a sense that there were structures to the psyche that anthropology would uncover, that there was a certain form that universally covered all cultures. And his idea of bricolage is that we have all the elements out there already, and that there is nothing actually new under the sun, but that what happens is that they get recombined. That we take something and juxtapose it with something else, and there's this kind of fresh approach because we're using old things in new ways. This is what postmodern architecture is about, what much of postmodernism is about, is that we're kind of past the idea that we're going to come up with this grand theory that's going to cover all of reality, but we're going to pick and choose and arrive at some new syntheses from old materials. And I think that's... Arthur Kessler called this bisociation, where two things that hadn't been previously associated get put together and there's a new synthesis. So as we're emerging out of the liminal, we're talking about a synthesis, carrying with you some way that you're working with the opposite. And Jung, you know, was very, very, he found it very important to carry the opposite. Not to deny one side versus the other, not to go too much in one direction, but to handle that tension. It's not going to resolve. He didn't think that there was going to be some magical harmony that arose. He said that in that tension, there's going to be a third that will arise that we have no notion of, because we've been too over-identified with either of the extremes. But if we can hold the tension, that this new birth will occur. And the new birth is what this is about. Verification is when you birth your project, when you actually go through the courage to get it out there and to let it be seen. Do you know how hard it is for so many people to let their art be seen? This hits people very, very deeply. This is like, oh, you know, I put these pictures on the wall and it's like my soul is just unfolded. You know, it's like I might as well be naked in this room, and I don't see that there's, you know, I have acted from that deep place in me, and then to have people come in and see these is very difficult. And it may be appropriate. I mean, you're going to need to figure out who is your forum, who is the audience for you. You know, it's not necessarily that we all need to be on MTV or that we need to have an exhibit at the Whitney or something. It may be that our audience is just those few people that we love and are significant to us. It may be that there is a broader audience, and that will require a certain letting go. But when you want to think of this, the transformation that needs to occur here is that the product itself needs to be like a new birth. And this is kind of in lieu of a conclusion, this is where I want to leave you, is that I think that people become too ego-identified with their work, that they think that it somehow will be assessed and they'll be judged in it. And it's true that we are judged. There is something very real about that. But I think parenthood is a wonderful model for the creative process, because for those of you that have children, you know that you have no idea what the life of that child is going to do. You don't. That child has this incredible spontaneity that will take on a life of his or her own, and parents that are able to let go enough to let the child develop their own self are much better parents than parents that need to have their child reflect them, that kind of narcissistic need to make sure that the child mirrors what they didn't get or what they're about, or you know, that's not particularly helpful. So if we can look at the work of art also, if we're following this line that there is an autonomous kind of sense that this work needed to come forth, that there was a pregnancy and a birth in this, that maybe we can allow the work to have a life of its own, which means that when others encounter that, their own psyches are going to be like in relationship with that work. Like if a child were to come up to me, there would be a special kind of relationship that we would work out. I may shun the child, I may be angry with the child, I may be playful with the child. We don't know. Just like with the work of art, you need to let go of the response from other people, because it's going to move some people. There's what good art does is it moves us. There's a certain sense of it hitting a chord, and each of the viewers is going to be different. So allow that work to take on a life and let it go. So let's have questions. Okay. Can I have a time check? How are we doing? Okay. Oh, let's have a break. Yeah, and take questions. Or you have your easel and your canvas up and you paint, but there's no passion. There's no real encounter with something that's mystery. There's this sense of kind of deadness, like it's lukewarm. And you may be producing work that is okay, but it doesn't carry something for you that involves this encounter, this place where there's this kind of free fall. That's a hard one. I mean, that is, all I can say about that is that if you could externalize your work to make it more like you're in relationship with this in some way, that there's a way that maybe you do it as a discipline, as your discipline, that you're still kind of like jogging, or like, I don't think that working out or jogging is a very good model of creativity, because one doesn't necessarily have a being that exists outside of one. Although some people, when they jog, they do have this kind of being that jogs with them, or they have these kind of these kind of very active imagination stuff that goes on during their exercise. But I think that maybe what I'd say to this is to try to personify your work. In this case, it was writing. Hillman talks about this need to personify the complexes, to get in relationship with them, to allow your writing, your art, your dance to take on a being. You know, this is the whole idea of the muses in the Greek, where they evoked a presence and then they interacted with that presence. So that maybe the passion is there because there's no one to be passionate with. And Hillman talks about our encounter with the archetypes as being a personal relationship, that we're in relationship with something. It's not just all come up out of some kind of, you know, platonic whims or, you know, just a kind of a wandering of ideas. It's really you evoke an energy, and that maybe you can become more passionate through the actual personifying of the art. Yeah. Challenge the work. Yeah. Uh-huh. Right. You invade it. You do something that actually, maybe you've been too polite with your work. That's the other thing, is that you're treating it with kid gloves, and maybe you need to kind of get your hand in there and feel around. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. The Gestalt people talk about that as a contact boundary. That, and in a lot of Gestalt work, there's this empty chair stuff where there's this real sense of you are in a dialogue with another part of yourself usually, but there's a contact boundary. There's a place where you're saying, oh, here it is. I know it's right here, and there's something here. So try to make it substantial as much as you can. Yeah. Yeah, so for you, and that is another whole way of being, is like to know that I can't rush this process. It's needing to find its own time. Yeah. Yeah. Good, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, very good. The sense that over life, your dips take on characteristics of previous experiences.
Yes.
Very much so, yeah. And so you could go stepwise, you could dip a little and come right back up. You could go even deeper where you're kind of down in places where there isn't much encounter, but there's a lot of darkness. And so you very much develop in yourself a relationship to your own history in terms of this work. The creative in you is like already, that's why we're all individuals. That's why this is a very, you know, kind of this generic piece that, that will be influenced certainly by our history.
And why do you think that this model works so well in
I think the reasoning in this is that in individuation, Jung saw that there was an emergence of the self, which is larger than the ego, that we have experienced who are, what our identity is through this construct called the ego, and that we have certain things that we're good at, certain things that we're, you know, we build a proficiency, we build a kind of a self-esteem based on the ego, and it works for us to a certain point, and then it begins to not work so well. And that is often at midlife, because the younger generation is coming up, they have new ideas, old ways are changing. You have a choice to either become really kind of the old king or old queen model, which is this old crotchety person that doesn't want to let anything new happen, you know, or you need to let go. And sometimes that letting go is just this descent, is this, oh, I'm no longer kind of the crown of creation. There's a new generation that are making different choices than I, and I have to be comfortable with that. So I think at midlife, there is this defeat of the ego. And what Jung wanted to do is to see that not as a dire, depressing kind of thing, but as an opportunity for the self to emerge. And what he said was, with the emergence of the self, the ego will feel defeated. And that there is something about midlife where this self then, which is much bigger, we don't really want it because we can't really identify with it. It's very hard to identify with the self because its very nature is non-containable. So it's a lot of letting go. And that's how I think it ties into developmental theory. I echo what you say. I think you're right on about that. I think that, that this is a hang-up for a lot of people, is that there has to be a product in order for there to be a process, right? For there to substantiate a very meaningful experience, you have to do a poem or you have to have a piece. And the art may be in the openness to that experience. The creativity may be just in that, in the way that you're with it. And so I think that's right. And I think it does connect very much to shamanic initiation, to initiation where there is kind of this separation and this shifting away from the collective. And it's the death and rebirth thing. It's the going down and the reemergence in a new way, which may not mean that there's a product, but there's a shift in consciousness. Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of my clients will come in and they say, I'm not creative at all. I don't have any creative, I don't have a creative bone in my body. And their dreams are magnificent. And it's right there. But what they're painting in their unconscious, what they've done in terms of their images, where, you know, since their egos are asleep and they're kind of like, that image I am not, or that diagnosis of themselves I'm not creative is put to sleep, then their dreams can show them that they have this incredible connection to liminal luminosity, to that imagistic place, and in the description of it, also in the way that people describe their dreams. I think we've got a long way to go, and there can be some very interesting ways that we do dream work. I mean, we could find that there are ways to express our dreams that may be more with movement, maybe more with being able to tell a story, the idea of narrative, that we turn the dream into a story. We make it and that may be artificial in some sense. We need to watch that we don't take the beauty of it in its originality into some other form. But my point is that people who often say they're not creative, I don't believe. I think that often they haven't expanded their own self-identification enough to identify what's creative to them.
That it's not just interpretation of the dream, but it's the enactment of the dream, that kind of original fulfillment of the dream. That way it seems like dreaming becomes itself a whole other art form.
Yeah. You know, Freud may be right about this idea that dreams are wish fulfillment, but it may be nothing like what he thought it was, because, you know, he thought that somehow we had to understand the dream and it was a symbol for some other libidinal desire or aggressive desire that needed to be found. What is the answer? If there's a mystery here that needs to find the... But what if the dream... What if the wish fulfillment in the dream is a desire to be expressed? Just like what you're saying, that fullness in expression, if you can find that fullness, that you're really meeting the desire of the psyche, that the desire of the psyche wishes to express itself. Now that's a pretty powerful thing, to think that we've got these psyches in us that are dying to be known, to be heard, to be seen in some way, how that's done. And I think that's why we are social creatures. I think that's why we need each other. Certainly it can be. I think that it depends on the person's need for isolation, and it depends on what, you know, there is, I think, a way that the psyche deals with unusual situations. Like if we were to go and isolate ourselves on a desert island and there would be this flowering of unconscious material, I think it's also Jung's belief, and he was very positive about the nature of the psyche, that there will be ways that the psyche take on a balancing effect, that if we're really true to psyche, that we can follow it, that it won't lead us into craziness, that we won't get more and more crazy. It's when we're fearful of psyche that we begin to get, you know, craziness is not this absolute openness to unconscious material. What happens in schizophrenia and other disorders is that there are defense mechanisms that come in where people get real concrete and real fixed on certain meanings to their experiences. They begin to think that, oh, that X, Y, and Z has occurred, that the FBI is after them because they're having this kind of nebulous experience. But that's a defense. You see, that's a way that they're trying to make sense. They're using their heads too much to make sense of something. What Jung wanted to do is to get back to the primary experience and let people be open to it, and to say, okay, we'll watch this experience and watch it shift, and we won't put meaning on it necessarily even. We'll let it happen, and maybe there'll be a figure out of a dream that'll emerge that will be a very caregiving image or person that will reoccur as kind of the protector.
You know, that's happened with a number of my clients. They get a little spacey, they get a little crazy, and out of their dreams emerge a character that has this kind of serenity. Even though it may be distant at first, there's a kind of an approach to a kind of a balancing figure that I think works. I think that will work for some people. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good. The question brought back to mind what is real for many, many people is that there isn't a real volitional act here. They're not saying, "Oh, okay, I'm doing a descent now." You know, it's not. This is really, you know, I think that more the case is that we have a trauma. We have very much like Persephone, which I didn't talk very much about, but. You know, she was pulled down to the underworld. She was abducted and raped. It was a trauma. It was like the divine just entered in and took her, and she had nothing to say about it. And for some people, it may not be that striking, but there may be a sense that the volition is not there. That people don't have a choice in this. They're just overwhelmed by it. And the key here, and not that everybody can get this right away in terms of when they're going down, that they can have an island of kind of their ego that kind of says, okay, or kind of like in a boat, like where they're on the boat and they're going down the rough waters, but they're at least on the boat. When I work with clients around this, I try to get them placed someplace so that they're not just kind of on the waters, but that they, even if it's on a very turbulent water or something's going on, that they're someplace, that there's a dream ego, so that they don't lose the ego. But the ego can be affected by things, but it's very important not to lose the ego. That was Jung was very careful about saying we need that central axis from where we can judge things, and it may be very painful, and we may momentarily are going to trance states or going to positions where we lose that, but it's important to try to keep that. Now for Persephone, what happened with her is that her abduction was actually the key to her power. She was at the point where she was just the daughter of Demeter. She was just a maiden. She was just a very naive young woman who would pick flowers. How she's pictured is just kind of la-di-da, everything is sweetness in life, and let's be positive about things. And she got pulled down into the underworld, and Hades began to have this relationship with her, made her his queen, and from that place she became the queen of the dead. There was a sense of her power and being empowered down there. She found this, even though it was a gruesome place, there was a place that she was able to establish herself down there. And that would be kind of the task, is to find a place of power down there. Like a friend of mine who went through this process talked always about being chased by this tiger, you know, being chased by the tiger and running from the tiger and being frightened of the tiger. And then at one point he did this kind of reversal, and he said, I'm going to face the tiger, I'm going to grab the tiger by the tail, you know, that old thing about I'm going to grab that energy, and instead of being opposed to it, I'm going to ride the tiger. I'm going to be on that energy. I'm going to find a relationship to it where I'm not the victim of it, but there's some kind of new, and it takes a fierceness. You know, Robert Bly talks about this fierceness about going down. I really like that, both in men and women's development. You know, the Women That Run With the Wolves talks about the same thing. Okay, does that help, or do you have... other, what kind? Yeah, not
the volitional part. It may be that in midlife, where the volition comes in, is that you reject the old mode of escape from going down.
Uh-huh.
So that if you used to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, or if you used to wander, or you used to go into relationships and so on, you may choose not to do that.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah, this sense of the volition being saying no to your old ways of avoiding it. Not necessarily volition in knowing where you're going, but saying, I've got to stop doing what prevents me from this. That's a very important piece. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Okay. Something that speaks to that whole issue of choice and that when we are chosen and when we choose, reminds me of what Jung had put over the front door of his house, which Latin and English means called or uncalled, the gods will be there.
Yeah.
And sometimes we call them and sometimes we are called.
Yeah.
But one way or the other, if we really are connected to life, they're going to be there and we're going to have to be a volition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you all hear that? It was a good point in that you're one, when they start this Jungian, when you're interested in Jung, you begin to recognize that it's a shift in your metaphysic. It's a recognition that that the gods may be reality.
And that you have a sense of personal willingness, but I think our culture really does not encourage this kind of process. I mean, I think people are seen as indulgent if they're spending time in this way, or codependent or sadomasochistic if they're with their pain.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's not very much permission for going into this. And I think there needs to be some kind of a context that the kind of forum needs to be at the start too, not just that personal process. I think it's sort of asking an awful lot in some sense of the common individual in life. I mean, sometimes it becomes a process for you to reach your chosen or the call.
Yeah.
You know. And I don't know how it would achieve
that. It's a good point.
It's
a point that was brought up at the break about a person that was experiencing this split, that when they started the descent and they were honoring their own creative work, that they felt that their work suffered, that they were gonna, that there was something about, well, I can't really go because I have got so many responsibilities and no one in my workplace would recognize or honor this, or I would never get any kind of leave. Creative leave. Wow, what a concept, you know? It's like, you know, we are not in a culture that does honor this. We're in a culture where efficiency and there's certain products that are made in redundancy, not in innovation, even though we're kind of innovative. America is very innovative in a lot of ways, but there is an elite that is kind of the innovators, and then the rest of us put that all into motion. And maybe there's ways that we can have corners of innovation in our life, but how can we bring this polarity, not so that we have to suffer in our lives in the world by being creative? You know, it's a shame that people have to make choices around that, but can't somehow find this. And that's a collective issue. That's what Hillman's trying to, you know, Hillman is moving really out of the individual work now, saying, we have got to be therapists of society. We have to move out of our individual work, because so what if we get individuals feeling better about themselves? If society doesn't change to help contain a new vision, we're being anti-revolutionaries. We're helping people kind of, you know, become narcoticized through their therapy and not say, I'm angry that there aren't more opportunities for me to be creative in my work life, for instance, and staying with that rather than saying, there now, that's a personal complex and you need to work on therapy in that, but say, maybe there's something valid in that we need to go out and look at.
Thank you.
certainly is something that needs to be brought in. And I see what you mean about putting the forum in the beginning, rather than having to be in the dark wood, seeing that the forum could be a place that one comes out of, too.
It's almost a sense of personal failure for those who don't go down. Even the top of the voice, some people choose to go back up. And I don't think, somehow it doesn't feel like it's just a personal issue. Again, it's a social issue.
Yeah.
People don't just go down to their front view or wherever else, but they're incredibly vast.
Most graphic designers in this country are trained as fine artists, which is a perceptual pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
You find that they get to a point where they're going down to those terms,
mm-hmm.
and then a societal conflict is thrust upon them because they would like to eat, and therefore they become graphic designers.
Yes.
And have to turn over the whole concept of art into a communication technique,
yeah.
where they are taking a message from a source, and they become a medium instead of the source.
Yes.
And then
they
have to communicate to an audience which is specified.
Uh-huh.
And I find this creates a terrific conflict in the
terrible.
Because they're being taken from a perceptual issue and forced into a cognitive linear approach.
Very much so that they get drawn down a line of their own sense of their own perceptions being validated, and then they get into a career where that can't come to fruition, that they need to be concerned about how the collective is communicating and work within that mode. Yeah. Yeah. How do you see any solution to this?
I've been working for years. I do see the solution, but I think it's beyond effective. And that is that you train graphic designers as graphic designers, and you train fine artists as fine artists.
Uh-huh.
Never shall the
twain
meet.
Yeah.
Because they're two different
psyches. Yeah. Yeah, David.
I just wanted to respond to something that was said a few minutes ago about the idea that perhaps this notion of calling, or this notion of responding to the unconscious and responding to the creative urge is more of an elitist sort of idea. To me, I think most people call. It's just that we no longer understand what the call is. Depression is a call.
Yeah.
Anxiety is a call. Back pain ulcer
mm-hmm.
is a call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Having your relationship in jeopardy or losing someone that you love is a call.
Yeah.
And you don't recognize those things as calls.
Yeah. And I think that's what Heidegger was getting to, is that being itself calls us. Being, just being. I mean, just in this room. And we have conditioned ourselves to avoid that, or to because perhaps all of you are calling in some way that is too chaotic for me. I think that calling can be also a little frightening. Because it demands our attention, or it demands something, a response. Heidegger talked about the calling requiring a response from us. Yeah.
Just to go back to the idea of public forum as a place not just the exposure of one's private or personal creativity, but in the recent exhibit to the Sacred Circle Gallery, one of the art pieces is celebrating mythic narrative, and that it's a verbal and multimedia experience, and that the Western experience has been linear. And sort of reveal truth. You know, the emphasis there was that each listener has a very unique response to the narrative that's spoken with music or the prompts, and so that it brings it back into a more universal experience, so that it isn't just the teller of the story who's having these wonderful experiences. Everyone is experiencing this, and somehow I think all of this does filter down to the concentration of a few people on the idea of, you know, listening to the person talking. That does filter down, and that eventually everyone can start listening.
Yeah, right. It's a different way of being in your that you carry that forth in some way.
Yeah, and it's just a constant emphasis on, you know, being able to open that up. And again, it is for everybody, right?
Yeah, thanks. You know, I wanted to offer you something that had also come up at the break. It was a very productive break, by the way. It felt very. What a number of people asked me about. They had heard about this group that I have that does this creative stuff. We get together once a week, and we and they're sitting right here. And they were saying, well, could we join, or is there a way to know about this group? And we have closed off our group. We're wanting to kind of keep our numbers down. But there was such interest that I was wondering if it might be valuable to have people from here be able to either put their name down and their phone number, and if someone in this group would be willing to take the sheet of paper and maybe call people and see if they could get just a support group around creativity going. Because, you know, we did it, we're having a great time with it. It doesn't take a lot, it's just finding a time when you can all meet and then letting it. What we do is we take different, each of us takes a different time, and we do some kind of creative activity. It might be singing, it might be dancing, it might be art. And then we have that opportunity to do it, and we get to know each other through the doing of those. And then each of us has a chance to come up with something. So I would be very willing to kind of have this at the desk over here. Would you be willing to kind of... Good, good. So as you go... If you want to sign that, I can just leave that with you and see this man right here, and maybe some group could get started to support each other in this work. Because I really feel that this idea of finding others to talk to about this is very important, that the isolation can feel very estranging. So that's the forum, too. Okay. So thank you all for coming.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.